So I wanted to say a little bit more about the force of kindness with different elements to it. First of all, I do want to say I see it as a practice. It's a skills training like anything else. It's other things as well, and I'll talk about those in a minute. But to the degree that we sense the development and the engendering and the deepening of kindness as a practice, then all of those ordinary elements come into play, like time and patience, setting an aspiration, I think, as high and as wide as we can, as much as we dare to imagine. That's the appropriate scope of an aspiration, you know, so it's not just to be a little bit nicer, but to really think about a radical transformation of the way we move through life, the way we treat ourselves, the way we see ourselves, the way we see others, to really set the bar high. And then to recognize, as we must, that transformation involves an unfolding. It's not a decision. Okay, I'm going to be perfectly kind from now on. It's a journey. It's a journey through all the ways we have learned to be withholding, to look the other way, to be timid, to feel we're not capable of much, to feel that retaliation is really strength. It's a journey through lots of ups and downs and highs and lows and challenges and openings, and that's what it actually is. You know, as was mentioned, I have a book coming out called The Force of Kindness, which I thought was a pretty good title. It was hard to come up with a title, but because with loving kindness and kindness, one of my greatest fears always is that it's going to seem sort of sickly sweet. I like to have some kind of punch in the title or in the sense of it that conveys a kind of power and not just that sentimental air. It's coming out in September, and at some point, not too long ago, I got the promotional material from the publisher. If they hear this, they're going to kill me. But anyway, and these things, those of you who have been involved in one way or another in publishing or writing, know that often when you get some material like that, it's accompanied by a letter which basically says, we really like this, we hope you do too. So right away you feel defensive, you know, like, uh-oh, I don't like it, what's wrong with me? And then this material came with a letter saying, basically, we're on deadline, please only change something if you really, really, really have to, because you really, really, really don't like it. So I opened it up, and the first sentence was something like, from the first instant you do this practice, comma, Salzburg promises, comma, your heart will melt like ice in the sun. So I wrote back to them and I said, you really, really, really have to change it because I really, really, really don't like it. I said, I would never promise that from the first instant you do a practice, you will have perfect results. You know, it will be that kind of immediate gratification. You know, that just plays into our kind of basic consumer orientation and the tremendous impatience of this society that if something doesn't happen instantly, it's not worth it. You know, we just denigrate it and throw it away. So I do not promise you. Far to the contrary, I can promise you, it'll take time. That this is a process. It's an unfolding because it's real. It's not just idealistic. It's not holding something in the abstract like, wouldn't it be great to be a fully enlightened person? Yeah, wouldn't it? But step by step, moment by moment, challenge by challenge, opening by opening, this is what makes it real, is to actually put something into practice, to come up against it, to find out where you're just not there. And maybe you don't want to be there in that particular situation. To understand that, to keep going on, you know, in life as it unfolds. That's the whole point. So the aspiration, setting that is really the first step. They say that when the Buddha taught, elements of his teaching were really like a kind of social revolution. The word dharma, which in Sanskrit, which we use to mean the Buddha's teaching or the nature of things or the truth or the laws of nature, had a kind of particular meaning in the society of India of that time, which had a lot to do with the caste system and people being born into different levels of society, different castes, and each having their own dharma in a sense, which had a sense of kind of almost fixedness, like people had a destiny, a role to fulfill, and not just people, but life. Different elements of life, like it was the dharma, almost like the duty of a cow to give milk and grass to be green, and as it translated to people of a certain class to rule and other classes to serve, and it was the dharma of a Brahmin male, not female but male, to study scripture and mediate with divine forces and that was sacred and appropriate and right, whereas for a female or for a male of another caste to do that very same thing was totally wrong. And so morality, integrity, appropriateness, moving through life with wholeness was really almost designed by birth. What was right for you might not be right for somebody else. What was right for them may not be right for you. And it was all determined in that moment of birth and caste and gender and so on. And the Buddha came along and said, well, none of that's true. That's all meaningless. That the force of goodness, of wholesomeness or unwholesomeness of any action is held in the intention, the motivation that gives rise to the action. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, if you're rich or poor, what caste you were born into. That's all irrelevant. The only status that matters is the status of personal goodness, not that kind of stratification of society. And so you can't say that an act born out of greed is going to have different consequences for a Brahmin than for an outcast. It's not. It's where the act is coming from. That's what gives it its power. And that was like a complete revolution because it overturned the whole social system of India of that time. And basically said, no one else is responsible for your actions. You are. You have to look within to what is motivating you, what's giving rise to what you're doing. That's how you'll know. And that there is no limitation, there's no sense of constraint based on the social class into which you were born. That's irrelevant. So that was a big deal in that time, and even in this time, to consider how we have certain elements of that weaving throughout a different society. So the intention behind an action is the marker of its integrity, its wholesomeness or its unwholesomeness. And this is where the aspiration for kindness, for loving kindness, for compassion is so crucial. It's not that we will be perfect, but we can understand the nature of coming from that place as compared to coming from a sense of separation and duality and uncaring, which is also very common. It's quite prevalent. So what we seek to do is to see the world in such a way that we understand our relationship to one another, and in such a way that kindness is seen as a value. It's not lesser. One of the reasons I wanted to write about it, actually, was that I got the feeling it was really like a second-class virtue. You know, like if you can't be brilliant, and you can't be courageous, and you can't be strong, and you can't be effective, well, be kind, you know. At least you can be kind. Maybe that's like a fifth-class virtue, I don't know. And I just wanted to give it more of what I think of as its rightful due, as an energy that's really very important. And it's subtle. It's not easy to understand. I can remember once I was at a conference some years ago in San Francisco that some friends of mine in New York put on with the Dalai Lama and very great notables and luminaries, and it was about peacemaking. It was called Peacemakers Conference, and it was a fantastic event on many levels. But I realized later that the thing I took away from it, maybe the most strongly, even though there were many, many things that were great, the thing that I actually was most impacted by was a casually overheard conversation. It had nothing to do with the presentations or anything that was going on formally. But I was walking by a group of people one day, which included Alice Walker, the writer, and I overheard her saying, as I get older, the thing that matters to me more than anything is goodness. It's good-heartedness. And I just walked on by. And later on, I realized that after days and days and days of lectures and discussion and questions and answers and all that kind of thing, that was it. That was like the jewel in it for me, which also has become kind of a marker for how I attend conferences now, you know, is that I realized that could be almost happenstance, you know, the thing that I really take away from it, a casually overheard conversation. And it was so striking for me because as I thought about it, I realized, yeah, you know, I really believe that. That all the things we long for and that we judge ourselves by and the status we want to achieve and how we want to appear in the eyes of others, and it's like all the flash and all the possessions and all of that, what happens with perspective? It doesn't matter that much. What really seems to last, to have steadfastness, to have power over time, is, I would agree, a kind of good-heartedness or goodness. That when I see it in people or I hear about it in people, I'm just awed. Because in the midst of the cruelty and the distress we are capable of causing and the greed and the separation and the jealousy, we are also capable of such tremendous goodness, manifesting in little ways and in big ways. It's quite amazing, and it's heartening. It just, I find it so uplifting. So I thought, yeah, you know, I actually agree with that. As I get older, I would say that what matters to me more than anything is a kind of goodness. But we don't, as a culture maybe, a society, maybe we don't celebrate it quite enough, you know, to understand this as a power. It's very difficult because we have such a tendency to hold very aggressive tendencies as powerful, and something that can be perhaps quieter, like kindness, is maybe not seen in quite the same way. But it's very powerful. I think any one of us, remembering a time when someone reached out to us or we had just given up and it was someone else's feeling like we could make it through, that had us make it through something. Or even just a kind of witnessed situation where you watch somebody help somebody else when they don't have to, or stop and talk when they don't have to. All those many things, I think, guide us right to that sense of how it can be a force. It can really make for very deep change. And of all the situations we find ourselves in, you know, there are so many where we just do not know what to do. There's no clear road. We don't have a sense of how one thing will lead to the next. All we can do is act from the best intention that we can find and come back to that intention over and over again and be open to the force of kindness coming our way, should it be coming our way. It's basically all we can do a lot of the time, and it's very powerful. Kindness, of course, manifests in countless different ways. Even just the examples that I just used, stopping, paying attention to somebody, listening, seeing if there is anything to be done. The research, I am told, most of it I didn't understand, but some of it got through. You know, these days where they, many scientists are like putting practitioners into an MRI machine and then saying, now do compassion meditation or something like that, to try to see the brain changes that come with compassion and with meditation. They said that as people engendered compassion, two main parts of the brain seemed to be affected. One was the pleasure center, that it's actually a good feeling. It's not the same as being shattered and overcome and broken by the pain of something, somebody, you know, it's not the same as being caught in one's own personal distress. It's a different feeling, like of oneness, of being close to, sharing. And the other part of the brain is the motor center, because this is urge to do. Not the same kind of urge, I would say, where we only feel good if we can get something done. Like, if we can't make somebody's suffering completely go away, we just feel powerless and helpless and you know, want to withdraw. It's not that. But it's the move toward being of help, if we can. So it's not just sitting around feeling bad. There's something that happens that kind of gets ignited in the brain, like, oh, you know, let me be there. Let me do something if I can. Let me come close. Let me draw near. So that's in the nature of compassion. So I'm using these words, loving kindness, compassion, kindness, almost interchangeably. There might be different kind of feeling tones associated with different aspects, you know, depending on what we might be experiencing. But they're very close. In some ways, you could say kindness is the most active manifestation. It's that moving toward, either energetically or through speech or through action. But it's born out of loving kindness and compassion. It's born out of how we see ourselves and how we see the world. And while it doesn't deny a fault or a difficulty, I think it also helps create the space around it. When we've made a mistake, I think if we're not feeling that force of kindness, the first thing that disappears is space. It's like everything collapses around that stupid thing we said or did. You know, we may have done 50 wonderful good deeds that very same day, gone. It's like all we are and all that we will ever be is that really silly thing we blurted out. We can't even imagine a bigger sense of who we are in that moment. Our attention collapses, our energy collapses, our sense of possibility collapses. And that one really stupid comment gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it's taken up everything. That's just the nature of judgment, of anger, of fear, so on. It's like this tunnel vision. So kindness will do the opposite. It doesn't say, well, that was fine what you said. Say it at every opportunity, you know. It's not that, but there's some space. There's space to recognize change, possibility, that you're bigger than that really foolish comment. There's more to life. There's more to everybody. You know, so instead of that tendency toward collapsing, it's about opening. And just as it is with others, it doesn't say, fine, do it again, you know. But we may not brand that person as only the one who has said that thing to me. We can open beyond that. We recognize what's difficult or inappropriate or conflicted or wrong as what it is. It's not getting confused and it's not trying to just paper it over and pretend it's something else, but how are we with it? Are we confined? Or can there be more space? That becomes the question. One of my favorite examples always is the Dalai Lama, and in this particular case, one particular story. I can't remember if I said this last year or not, but I went last year in the spring to Toronto, where the Dalai Lama was spending 11 days doing this ritual known as the Kala Chakra, which is a very elaborate teaching and ritual. It was a beautiful kind of experience where every morning he just practiced up on the stage. So if you were there in the morning, it was like you were doing your meditation with the Dalai Lama, and it was very beautiful. And then in the afternoon, he would either be speaking or they would be doing the ritual. And he liked to begin every afternoon in sort of his ecumenical spirit with having different people chant. People from different Buddhist traditions do chanting. And one afternoon they actually had a rabbi up there. You know, it was like, it got way out there. but normally it was the various Buddhist groups that were represented. And he would do it chronologically in terms of the spread of Buddhism throughout the world. So he'd start with the Theravadan Buddhists, and people from Sri Lanka or Southeast Asia would chant, and then Northern Buddhists, the Mahayana schools, and Korean, and Chinese, and Japanese, and so on. And the first afternoon, it was fine. The people from the Theravadan tradition, the schools of Southeast Asian Buddhism, were actually both Westerners, who a monk and a nun who had ordained in those traditions. And then he went on. And then in the second afternoon, the monk wasn't there. There was just this nun. So imagine this scene. You're sitting up on a stage in front of maybe 7,000 people. The Dalai Lama is sitting on a throne behind you. And you have to sing, in effect. Pretty scary. So she starts to chant, and because it's also my tradition, I knew right away she was making lots of mistakes. You know, she had this little wobbly voice. it was so sweet and so painful to listen to her. And the things, you know, because these are very traditional chants. Some things you're supposed to say three times, and other things you're supposed to say once, and the things you're supposed to say three times, she was saying once, and the things you're supposed to say once, she was saying three times, and it was all kind of getting confused, and she was mispronouncing things, and, you know, and like finally it was over. And they went on to some other nationalities, you know, to go on and do the chanting. And then at the end of that period, the Dalai Lama paused and he said, "I just want to thank everybody who did the chanting." He said, "Especially that nun." He said, "She had to chant all alone and it's not very easy. And, you know, she did a beautiful job." And then he said, "I once had to chant all alone. I went to Japan and they asked me to chant the Heart Sutra, which is a very famous Mahayana Sutra. And he said, I made so many mistakes. I feel like I made up a whole new Heart Sutra." And then he looked at her and he said, "Perhaps you did too." And it was just so sweet, you know, because it acknowledged fully, you know, that it wasn't perfect. But he also went right underneath that to the intention and the heart space and what it meant for her and, you know, how much it took for her to be able to do it. And he acknowledged that fully. It was just such a perfect moment of kindness, I thought, you know, to take the time and portray it all, like the whole picture of what had happened. It was really beautiful. So then she came up to me, because we know each other, she came up to me in the afternoon and she said, "Do you want to chant with me tomorrow?" And I said, "No, thank you." But she was completely radiant. It was like someone had lit a light inside of her that was just so beautiful. And with instances like that, I mean, of course, he is the Dalai Lama, but I realized, you know, it actually doesn't take that much sometimes. It wouldn't cost us that much, if anything, to stop and acknowledge somebody or make a point of, you know, when we've witnessed that something is really difficult, to just acknowledge that, wow, you know, that was tough. You did good. You know, in some way, to be generous about things, you know, because generosity is not just material, of course. You know, it's about taking the time, giving of ourselves, being with. You know, not looking the other way, making some effort, saying thank you. All of those things are really what generosity is about. And they say that all practices of generosity come from some kind of feeling of inner abundance. Material generosity comes from that, because when we don't feel we have enough, we don't give. We can't. You know, if we feel we can, then even if what we have to give is small, we feel good about giving it. And spiritual, you could call it spiritual generosity or generosity of the spirit, comes from the same place. So, for example, when we do loving kindness practices, we'll do tomorrow, one of the categories, you might say, of beings we offer loving kindness to is a benefactor. That's someone who's helped us, or maybe we've not met them directly in this life, but it's somebody who's inspired us or uplifted us. And many people tell me that they actually choose the Dalai Lama as the object of their loving kindness. And many people come to me afterwards and then say, "I thought that was a really stupid choice, you know, because I was doing it and then I was thinking, what does he need me for? You know, how could my well wishes, or in another tradition you'd say my prayers, make any difference for him? You know, he doesn't need me." And I think it's exactly that moment we need to look at. I have nothing to give. What I have to contribute couldn't be good enough. I can't make a difference. You know, my small contribution can't build into anything greater. That sense of depletion or deficiency, not being enough, not having enough, is what will hold us back from even these small acts of kindness, which are very impactful, which can make a difference to the individuals involved and to the world. So we come back to holding that intention. It's important. And then doing what needs to be done to actualize that slowly, step by step, facing our fears, facing that conviction that we're not enough, we're not important enough, we're not good enough, going on. Seeing the next hurdle, going on. Forgetting altogether that it was ever a desired quality, and then remembering and going on. It's a path, like any path, it's a journey. And it's really something that we can bring and do bring into every aspect of our lives. So do you have any questions or comments before we just walk in? Yeah. Renunciation, did you say? The question was, what's the relationship between renunciation of certain ideas and the development of kindness? So it might be looking at somebody and just sort of saying, oh, that person's mistreated me, so I'm not going to be kind to them, and being able to somehow let go from that. Well, I think, you know, it's really a perfect kind of description of what a path is and what a path made real is. It's, first of all, very important to know what we're feeling, not to deny it, you know, not to sort of say, I shouldn't feel that, you know, what kind of horrible person I am, I'm still resentful, I'm still holding on. Not to build, you know, a whole self-identity of having failed at kindness, you know, because of what comes up in our thoughts or in our feelings. We're genuinely not going to be able to control that in terms of the arising. I mean, of course. So to know what we're feeling quickly. And then in a way, it's like having the tools to skillfully, humorously, with great love for ourselves, let go of that which is really holding us back. You know, that which is not bringing us to the life we want to live. So, for example, sometimes when I'm teaching sympathetic joy, which is the practice of feeling delight in the happiness of others rather than feeling jealous and envious and like, oh, I feel bad because you have so much going for you. And those feelings of jealousy and envy are said to come from the sense that happiness is like a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less there's going to be for us. So we see someone doing well and we get kind of fretful, you know, like something's been stolen from us in a way. But really, are we going to be any happier because they lose everything? No, but, you know, we live as though that's true. Sympathetic joy, in contrast to that envy and jealousy, is really being happy when seeing the happiness of others. It's realizing nothing's taken away from us by that. Our lives actually can be enhanced by that. And I think we all know from being recipients or not the beauty of that quality. So, you know, when something really good happens for you and someone is really, really happy for you and how wonderful that feels. And on the other hand, when something really good happens for you and other people are not so happy about it and how crummy that feels. So we get a sense of that quality. So that quality of sympathetic joy is powerful, it's liberating, it's important, and it's said to be not that easy. For a number of different reasons. That doesn't mean impossible, but challenging for most people. Some people actually have it almost naturally in their character, and I just find that just awesome. You know, really beautiful. Yesterday, when I had a whole saga, you know. I had a flight from New York City to St. Louis, and then the same flight, it was just supposed to stop in St. Louis, the same flight to go on to here. So my flight out of New York was an hour late, and I checked with the airline, you know, am I going to miss my connection? They said, no, you can't miss your connection, it's the same flight, you know, so it's just going to leave later. So first I was concerned, then I was appeased. Then I landed in St. Louis, and the flight attendant said, oh, you've got to go to another gate. And I said, why do I have to go to another gate? It's the same flight. And she said, I don't know, but they have it leaving from this other gate. So it was one other woman and I, kind of a young, very young woman. And I went to this other gate, and they said, oh, that flight already left. It left like an hour ago. And I said, how could it have left? It just arrived. And they said, no, it left. And I said, what flight number was it? And it was the same flight number. And I said, how could you have two flights in the air with the same number? They said, gee, that's interesting. Yeah, thank you. You know, so then they said, I'll go back to that gate. So I went back to the gate, and there was nobody there. And then we went over this other gate, and there was nobody there. And then we went over another gate. Somebody said, we can't help you. We just deal with American connections. We don't deal with American Airlines. So then we went on another gate. And it was just like, so it was this young woman and I who, like, bonded, you know, and running all over. It was like the Twilight Zone. I was like, this is so weird, you know, like, where's the airplane? You know, and it was just like a whole mess, and then we both had to leave and go to the terminal and then come back, and then they put me on another flight, and then I ran back in through security to get to that flight, which was going to go to Denver, and then that was going to connect me to here, and that flight was late, so then I was going to miss the connection, so that didn't work, so then I had to go back out, and then it was just like, and then I got to this, like, gate, and there's the young woman, and they're putting her on the next flight to here, the only direct flight, which at that point was going to arrive at midnight, which for both she and I is 3 in the morning, you know, on East Coast time. And they're saying to her, well, we'll really try to get you a seat on first class. And I looked at her, and I looked at them, and I looked at her, and I thought, good. She needs it, you know. So that was like a perfect moment of sympathetic joy. I was like, yeah, go for it. Give it to her. It's a beautiful quality, but it's hard to get to because so much can intrude that we need to let go of. Like, I was here first. If you hadn't put me on that stupid flight to Denver, you would have given me the first class seat. You know, she's young. She can handle it. I mean, a million thoughts come up, of course. But it's not, you know, and I guess this is the point I'm trying to make, it's not an ordeal to let them go. It's not like you have to give yourself a lecture and say, oh, I'm a horrible person, I can't believe it, look at how young she is, you know, like, can't believe I'm thinking that again. I'm so selfish. I wanted a first class seat. I can't believe they're going to do it. Why aren't they doing it for me? You know, it's like whatever comes up, you kind of see it for what it is. Yes, let it go. It's that gracefulness and that ease and that compassion and that kindness we are practicing every single time our mind wanders from the breath. That's what we're practicing. And then we bring it into life. You know, so you see these things, you feel their effect, how frozen you get, and how stuck things get, and how oppressive things get. You let it go. You go on, and you don't feel disheartened because you have to let go again and again and again. That's really the practice. What happened? Six and a half hours later in the St. Louis airport, they had put us both on the direct flight, which was supposed to be an hour delayed, and I glanced up at the monitor and it had gone back to its original time, so instead of arriving here at midnight, I arrived at 11. And I don't know where she sat. I didn't sit in first class. I don't know where she sat, but it was so wonderful, you know, kind of in that arc of looking at one's mind and one's reaction. When I got that hour back, it was like the most joyous moment. And I thought, if anyone had told me in the beginning of the afternoon, you're going to have a 6.5 hour layover I would have freaked out. But because it wasn't a 7.5-hour layover, I was filled with joy. I thought, look at that. It all depends on one's perspective. Isn't that true? And then all the other sort of nightmare scenarios I painted. My luggage won't be there. There won't be any taxis. You know, I mean, none of that came true. So once we sort of broke with the hour, broke the karmic tendency, whatever it was, and then I felt good. And I decided I'm too old to travel the day before I have to teach. I'm going to have to get 2 days in so that there's a day to make up for whatever happened, you know, in terms of the travel. Yeah.
I'm trying to tie this into kindness. And it sounds like mindfulness is really connected to mindfulness because you have to be aware of what's going on. And my question pertains to forgetfulness becoming a side effect of mindfulness, possibly. And I'm wondering if it's, for me, a warning sign, a good sign that I'm going the right way, you know, because I am forgetting things, or if I should be scheduling a CAT scan.
The question was about forgetfulness seeming to deepen as he's working on mindfulness. And is that a good sign or not? It is actually a common experience, but I don't think it's enduring. One's brain kind of settles down or something. There are periods often of forgetfulness. I think that has not so much to do with the development of mindfulness, but it's almost, I think, a part of the development of tranquility, where we're just not so hyped up and trying to absorb everything and recollect everything and keep everything. And we're just sort of easing down, you know, revving down. And after a while, I think that comes into some balance so that there's more mental acuity that returns as we're paying attention. And you're right, you know, the mindfulness in some ways is the link between values of kindness and loving kindness and sympathetic joy and compassion and all of that, because that's what helps make it real. Otherwise, it's something we admire, either in someone else or as an ideal. But how do we make it real? Okay, we know what we're feeling. We know what we're thinking. We have a sense of what we care about, which, say, is kindness. And we are able to let go of that which is taking us away, and to further and deepen that which is bringing us closer. And the Buddha talked about it in terms of the four great efforts, if I can remember them, which are something like seeing those tendencies toward the skillful which have already arisen and enhancing them, and those tendencies toward the skillful which have not yet arisen, and like creating the ground for them to come up, and that which has arisen that is unskillful, learning how to relinquish it, and seeing those tendencies which have not yet arisen, which are unskillful, and not creating the ground for them to be there. And that's considered like the, it's like the essence of the path, is those four great efforts. I think he said it better than that, but I can't quite get it. Yeah. Could you speak up a little bit? Because I am older. Okay, the question is about being intrusive in offering kindness or presence when you see that somebody is in trouble. Well, we might be, I suppose, you know. I mean, it all depends on the situation. Like in intensive retreats, we ask people not to, if somebody's crying, not to go up and try to comfort them, for example, you know, because it's like for many people, it's like they're finally in a situation where they can be in touch with what they're feeling, and they don't want to end up taking care of this other person instead of kind of reassuring them, like, I'm okay, you know. Don't worry about it. So there may be certain contexts in which it's not really appropriate. But for the most part, I think it comes down to, you know, which will we regret more looking back? Maybe not saying or doing perfectly the right thing, you know, or not having approached. And I think it's pretty clear that we will regret the hesitations and the ways we didn't even come forward. Because for the most part, I mean, what I know from my experiences of being troubled, and I think what most people will say when they're ill or going through loss or something's going on, is that you don't even remember what the person said. You know, very often you just remember they showed up, and that's what's most valuable. So, yeah. Okay, the comment was about making efforts toward kindness and having that met with meanness and coldness, and you, I think, beautifully answered your own question, because I was thinking just that as you were speaking. And I know I've often quoted, first Neem Karoli Baba, who is a great Indian teacher, who said, never throw anyone out of your heart. Never throw anyone out of your heart. And then the addendum to that is from my friend and colleague Sylvia Borstein, who said, never throw anyone out of your heart. You may throw them out of your life, but never throw them out of your heart. And that's a pretty crucial understanding. I think there are many situations where what we can do is internal, it's energetic, it's wishing someone peace, to be relieved from suffering, which is also causing suffering for others, to work with our fear, our distaste, you know, whatever it might be. That's the work. It's not going to be in, like, bringing them into our home or into our life. And we don't know that that won't form a resolution of some kind in real life, real encounters, but we can't do it for that purpose, because that becomes not loving kindness but attachment. You know, like, I'd like you to be happy by tonight, so have a decent night's sleep, so you're not, you know, playing that loud music or whatever. It's something different than that. And so I think you answered it beautifully. You know, that's the work, is not necessarily having kind of a smiling encounter, you know, where you'll get crushed again, but inside, to be working on wishing them well, even though they've been nasty, you know, and it's not well in the sense of triumph, like may you go on and be nasty to more and more people and take over the neighborhood or something like that, you know, but you know, in a much more authentic sense of, you know, may you be free. Just like I want to be free of the things that, you know, catch me up and have me cause suffering, so may you too. And see what happens. Okay, so let's do some walking practice and we'll come back and have more time for discussion and a sitting practice.